Hello, I am Farah Khan. This is Prof Talk. Last February 2010, a magnitude earthquake the size of 8.8 shook the country of Chile. A few days after the megaquake, a team of Canadian engineers went to Chile and traveled throughout the country from Santiago to Concepcion to observe the effects of the quake and its resulting tsunami on buildings, bridges, schools, and hospitals. The team was led by UBC Civil Engineering Professor Carlos Ventura, along with Professor Perry Adibar. Today, I have the pleasure to have Dr. Perry Adibar live in the CITR studio to discuss his current engineering research post-Chile, as well as some exciting developments in understanding how concrete behaves. Dr. Perry Adibar is a professor of structural engineering in the UBC Department of Civil Engineering. His teaching and research interests are in the design of concrete structures, with a particular emphasis on seismic design of high-rise concrete buildings. The research that he has been involved in over the past 20 years has had a direct impact on Canadian design practice, including the seismic design of concrete wall buildings. Tomorrow, aspects of Perry Adibar's recent research will be on the show Daily Planet on the Discovery Channel, which marks the 311-year anniversary of the mega earthquake that hit British Columbia in the year 1700. Dr. Perry Adibar joins me now. Perry, welcome to Prof Talk.
Thank you.
I thought it would begin a brief discussion about structural engineering as a field of practice. Can you give us a simple definition of what structural engineering is?
Well, structural engineering is an important part of the more general field of civil engineering. And civil engineering has to do with essentially building things and maintaining things that are needed by the civilians, by people, by society. Structural engineering specifically deals with the design of structures like buildings, bridges, dams, and those sorts of structures.
Now, what is the goal of structural engineers? What do they ultimately hope to achieve?
A design of a structure that is economical, that can be built with the minimum amount of resources, both financial resources and environmental or natural resources. A structure that's safe, that keeps the occupant safe, keeps the user safe. Structures that are beautiful, serve their purpose.
That's right. And so let's talk about concrete, because it's just some of us may take it for granted. I mean, what is reinforced concrete? It's a material that has been used for the last century. And so what kinds of research of concrete still exists today? And why is it used so much? And why are you so fascinated about concrete?
Well, that's a great question. As you say, it's a very old material, and it's really stone and sand mixed with various materials that glue it all together, called Portland cement. And as you say, it's a very old material, so you think it's a simple material, but actually when you combine it with reinforcing steel and then produce complex structures, it turns out to be a very complicated material. The way it behaves, once it gets damaged, when an earthquake hits a structure, it causes cracks, it causes damage, and a structural engineer needs to understand how it'll behave after that damage has occurred. So it's actually a very complex material, one of the most complex materials. The combination of concrete, which is itself a mixture of materials, and then you add reinforcing steel in many different complex ways and build complex shapes under complex loads, well, you can see it's all complex. So very, very interesting, fascinating material in the end.
And why did you decide to dedicate your life to studying this material?
That's a great question. I took an interest in it very early on. It's one of the most commonly used building materials in the world. I mean, all over the world, everyone has sand and stone, and so they can make concrete very easily. It's widely used in Canada. It's very widely used here on the West Coast. Most of our buildings are made of concrete. So it's a very important material for Canada, for North America, for the world. So I think that's probably why I got interested in that, and the fact that it is so complicated and so challenging, and that there are so many questions we still have to try to understand the answers to. So there's a bunch of reasons why I find it an interesting area to work.
Now, I'd really like to talk about your experience in Chile last year, because there's a lot of exciting developments, I mean, post-Chile. So can you tell us about the trip and sort of give us a picture of what happened down there? And then, of course, we'll get into some of your current research.
Okay. Well, it was actually my first visit to an earthquake damage zone. So it was an amazing trip for me. It was Chile is a beautiful country. I'd never been there before. It's a very modern country, very much like Canada. So I enjoyed being in Chile for that reason. It was a very large earthquake, as you mentioned. But in some ways, that's deceiving because we've seen smaller earthquakes, much smaller earthquakes that have done much more damage. That earthquake was really very much like smaller earthquakes back to back. So the damage isn't really as large as you might expect, given that the number was a magnitude 8.8. But we saw a lot of damage, not as much as I first expected. The damage was isolated. But the thing that was very surprising is what we saw that was damaged was primarily newer buildings. And that was scary. You wonder, why are these new buildings falling down? And is there something they're doing wrong? And their construction methods are not that different than what we do here in Canada. And so the important question is there something to be learned from that? And do we need to do something differently in Canada?
And so how did you see these damaged buildings? I mean, did you just go through them as a team? How did the process work?
We split up into a number of different teams. It was 10 Canadian engineers that were part of a team. And I had the pleasure of actually traveling around with one of the engineers here in Vancouver, Rob Simpson, who's a structural engineer and has a similar interest to me. And we were joined by Adrian Whiteman, who is a geotechnical engineer. And the three of us were a three-man team, and we drove around the country. Rob and I were very interested in high-rise buildings, so we went around looking for damaged high-rise buildings, and we found some very interesting ones. What was interesting is there was army and police preventing people from entering into any of the buildings, but we would just say Ingenieros Canada, and they would move and let us enter the buildings, and we actually were quite brave. Perhaps we were dumb. We would walk right into the damaged buildings and have a good look at what we could find. It was very interesting.
And were there any aftershocks?
There were some very large aftershocks. In fact, over a magnitude 7. And that in itself was an exciting part of the trip, is to actually, the first time I felt it, I was actually with Rob. We were standing in the hotel, and all of a sudden the ground started shaking. And that was the first time I'd felt such a large earthquake. And that was worth the trip right there, just to feel. I mean, to be in earthquake engineering and not have yet experienced a large earthquake. So that was, in a sense, terrific. It was also very scary. We were living in a hotel. It was not very tall. It was 8 or 9 stories. It was an older hotel. It was quite damaged from the earthquake. And we'd go to bed at night knowing that during the night there could very likely be another big earthquake. And so I put my wallet in a place where I could find it. I put my shoes in a place where I could find them. And I was ready to run out of the building if I needed to. So all of that was a very valuable part of the experience.
Now, what have you learned from Chile?
Well, as I said, the big thing that we saw right away was that there are lots of new buildings that were damaged. Chile has the advantage that we don't have, is that they get a significant earthquake every 20 years. So the good news is that the earthquake calls out the bad buildings. So they've learned what doesn't work, and the old buildings that don't work have fallen down, and most of their buildings are smartly designed. And so to have these new buildings collapse, obviously it was very, very important. One of the things we noticed was that many of the shear walls were very thin. Many of the columns were very thin. And so we thought that perhaps had some explanation. That was part of the reason. And in fact, from the research we've done since then, we've learned that in fact is the case, that the thinness of the walls played a role in the walls failing and causing the buildings to collapse.
So let's talk about your lab and what you have discovered in the various tests that you've done on the concrete.
Okay, well, we have a pretty sophisticated structures laboratory at UBC. We have a number of them. We have a lab where we do shake table testing, an earthquake lab. We also have a large lab where we do large tests on sort of slowly loaded elements where we can study what's happening, and we call that the structures lab. And this summer, I had a group of students working with me. We built some 6-inch thick wall elements, and we simulated the loading that the walls would have experienced during the earthquake. We did it under slow loading so we could observe what was happening. And we expected that these wall elements would compress about 3 to 4 millimeters per meter of height. So that was the sort of normal result we've seen in previous tests. And that's the result, or the number, that engineers think that the concrete wall can tolerate during an earthquake. That is, it can compress 3 or 4 millimeters per meter. And we saw in some of the small elements where we had included column ties, not what they're called non-seismic column ties, just some reinforcing steel tying the wall together through the thickness of the wall, we actually saw the result exactly as we expected. The walls tolerated 4 or 5 millimeters of compression strain per meter of height. So that was not really, in a sense, it was confirmation that it can work. On some of the wall elements, the ones that did not have reinforcement tying the two faces together, the wall elements literally exploded when they got to a strain of 1 millimeter per meter. Mm. So at a quarter of the strain we expected, these wall elements failed. And the first time that happened, I thought it was a testing mistake. Mm-hmm. And the second time it happened, I realized it's not. And when we did it 3 and 4 times, and we carefully monitored what was going on, we started to realize there really was something here, that a thin wall element will fail in compression at a much smaller strain than we would ever have guessed. So it was a significant result.
And so is that kind of how you concluded what had happened in Chile with a lot of these modern buildings that you saw collapse?
Yeah, when we look at the failure of these thin wall elements, the kind of crushing that occurred looks very similar to the kind of crushing we saw. The predominant failure mode we saw, what you would call a flexural compression failure of the shear wall. So on the compression side, the wall was compressed and failed. And so, yes, I think this goes a long way to explaining the failures we saw in Chile.
And so how do these kind of events impact the current design and construction codes? I mean, how do you bring the research in your lab to the engineer working in the design office?
Well, it so happens that I chair the group of engineers or the committee of engineers that are working on updating the Canadian code. So we have a building code that engineers use when they do their designs. And we have already discussed these results amongst that group. And, mm-hmm. and we certainly plan to modify the requirements in the building code to reflect this latest research. The interesting thing is the repair is quite simple and quite mm-hmm. inexpensive. On the end of every thin concrete shear wall, you will now need to provide, once it's implemented in the code and everyone agrees that it should be, then we will need to provide a minimum amount of what's called column ties, non-seismic ties, to prevent the concrete from simply exploding, to keep it contained reasonably. Now, I should also mention that most of the buildings we build today do not have these thin 6-inch walls. Most of our buildings have quite thick walls, and this is not a problem, or not nearly as much of a problem in a thick wall. So we don't build a lot of 6-inch walls here in Canada. They do in Chile. Now, we do have existing buildings in Canada with 6-inch walls. So perhaps the more important question is, what do we do about the fact that we have existing buildings that have these walls and where it's very difficult to make a simple change? Mm-hmm. You know, with new construction, we can just add a little bit more reinforcing steel and the problem goes away, mm-hmm. or avoid 6-inch walls. But what do we do about the existing buildings that are all out there?
And I'm just curious, how long does it take for a construction code or to actually change and be implemented once it goes from the lab, you know, research to the actual?
That's a great question. It varies depending on what the issue is. Just a couple of years ago, we discovered something that is related. I won't explain it in detail, but it relates to long columns in high-rise buildings.
Okay.
And we realized that was a problem. And the code committee all agreed it was a problem. And we made an emergency change to the code within a year. We are lucky in that an amendment to the code was coming out, so it was easy to do. But it is possible, if needed, to make a change very quickly. Normally, the building code is on a 10-year cycle. And during the process of writing the new building code, it's relatively easy to bring in the latest research results. So that's normally how it gets in. It gets part of the regular 10-year cycle where the code is updated with the latest research results.
Now, is Chile also a good example because of the kind of earthquake that happened in that country? I mean, in terms of the kind of earthquake we would expect here on the West Coast?
Absolutely. They talk about an earthquake very much like that happening here in the ocean. It's some hundreds of kilometers away from Vancouver, but a large subduction earthquake could occur here. In fact, that's what occurred almost exactly 311 years ago, right? Mm-hmm. In 1700, January 26, I guess that's tomorrow. Mm-hmm. In 1700, there was they believe a magnitude 9 earthquake, mm-hmm. very similar to the magnitude 8.8 that occurred in Chile. So we do get those same large earthquakes here. In fact, I've heard that the one we can get could be a lot longer than the one that was in Chile. In Chile, it lasted for 2 minutes. I've heard people that know this, they've told me that it could be up to 4 minutes. So it could be a very large earthquake. The good news is that the subduction zone is quite a distance away from Vancouver. So the good news is that even if that very large earthquake was to occur, the damage levels in Vancouver aren't going to be that large. I mean, may not be that large. So we actually have to worry more about some earthquakes that could occur right below the city of Vancouver, an intraplate or subplate, subcrustal plate earthquake. There are different types of earthquakes, and the ones that could occur closer to the city of Vancouver could actually produce more damage than the larger earthquake further away.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about sort of a myth that a lot of us have, that the stronger the structure, the better. Can you explain whether that's really true for earthquake engineering?
Yeah, that's a great point. Now, I've heard people say that strength is necessary but otherwise unimportant for earthquake engineering, and that's a useful saying to think about. The earthquake actually causes the ground to move. The bottom of the structure moves, and the top of the structure needs to keep with it. Now, either it's very stiff and very strong and it stays with the bottom all the time, or it has to deflect, it has to bend. And in a tall building, it's not really nothing to do with strength. In a 20-story building, in a 30-story building, the issue has very little to do with strength. It has to do with the fact that the base of the building is going to move 200 millimeters or 300 millimeters relative to the top. The top is going to stay where it is, the bottom's going to move 200 millimeters, 300 millimeters, and the building between the top and the bottom has to be able to deform to tolerate that movement. So in earthquake engineering, it's much more really about displacements and the ability to deform than it is about strength. Strength is necessary. We need a certain level of strength. It's important, but it's not nearly as important as the ability to deform or deflect without collapsing.
And here's a question for you. What are the kinds of structures that give you the wow factor?
Me personally, you mean?
Yes.
All kinds, I guess. I mean, there's lots of amazing structures, but obviously the really tall ones. When I look at pictures of Hong Kong, I mean, I've never been to Hong Kong, but when I see that many tall, thin, high-rise buildings, that gives me a wow. I mean, well, when I was in Shanghai and I looked at some of the newest, very tall office buildings in Shanghai, that gives me the wow factor. I like tall buildings. Maybe it's because I'm so frightened of heights that somehow I get a thrill when I look at these really tall buildings.
So how did you really get into this aspect of engineering? I mean, because, you know, structural engineering is part of civil, and civil engineering, of course, is part of the main, you know, applied science. So maybe
how
you
did
can
I
just,
get specifically into high-rise buildings?
Yeah.
That's an interesting story. When I moved here 21 years ago to become a young assistant professor, I'd come straight from my PhD. I'd learned about concrete structures, but I'd never actually been a designer. So after I was here for a while, I took a sabbatical and I went to work with some engineering companies in Vancouver. And while I was Reed Jones Christofferson and Jones Kwankishi, and when I worked for these companies, I realized that the people designing high-rise buildings have a lot of questions, particularly related to seismic design, a lot of questions that they didn't have the answers to. And so when I went back to UBC and started my research again, I found myself spending all my time looking at these questions that the people in industry have mm-hmm. about designing high-rise buildings, and I've really never looked back. Surprisingly, there's so much we still need to learn about mm-hmm. how to design high-rise buildings that it's keeping me and many of my students busy.
And so what's the next step in your research? Where are you heading?
Well, there's still a lot, right? We have a new code coming up in 2014, and mm-hmm. we have a very ambitious list of things we want to change in the code. There are many things we know need to be improved, and many of my PhD students and master's students are all very busy working at trying to find the answers to these issues. So mm-hmm. right now, next couple of years, I have 2 years left to come up with the research results to implement it in the 2014 code. So we're focused on that for the next couple of years.
And what kinds of things are going to be in that code?
Well, there's I'm not sure how technical you want me to get, but there are all kinds of issues about design that we really can improve. For example, the way we design high-rise buildings right now is we think that if the building yields at the base of the building, if the building becomes plastic, is damaged at the base of the building, then the rest of the building will be protected from earthquake damage. So currently when we design a high-rise building, at the bottom of the building, we put in lots of extra reinforcing steel so that it can tolerate the damage at the bottom. And we don't put any of that through the rest of the height. Well, we now know that a tall building, even a 20-story building, could easily be damaged near the mid-height, and that we need to provide special reinforcement near the mid-height for that damage. So that's an example. And so the question is, how much reinforcement, how much damage could happen at mid-height of a 20-story, at a 30-story, at a 50-story? And so, and that's an important issue, that we've been designing it one way, and we realize that actually what could happen is quite different. And there are lots of other issues like that. The surprising, it's amazing to think about how simplified some of our design methods are and how significant some of the changes need to be.
Well, thank you, Perry, for joining us this afternoon. It's been such a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure for me, too. Thank you very much.
You are listening to Prof Talk on UBC CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver and via live web streaming on CITR.ca. I've just been speaking with Professor Perry Adebar from the Department of Civil Engineering. If you would like to learn more about his research, you can visit his website from the civil webpage at www.civil.ubc.ca. Tomorrow, January 26, Perry Adebar's research will be featured on the show Daily Planet on the Discovery Channel. On February 15th, in 2 weeks' time, we will continue this discussion as I will interview Dr. Adebar's colleague, Professor Carlo Ventura, who is currently the director of the Earthquake Engineering Research Facility at UBC. And next week on Prof Talk, I will speak with Dean of Arts Gage Avril, who was recently nominated for a Grammy Award for his project, Alan Lomax in Haiti, Recordings for the Library of Congress, 1936 to 1937. If you would like to hear a podcast of this show or any previous episode of Prof Talk, you can visit citr.ca. And please do check out our blog at ubcproftalk.blogspot.com. And I'd like to end today's show with some music from Chile as we think about some of the lessons learned there in structural and seismic engineering. I am Farha Khan. Thank you for listening today. Chile me voy.